early on, I used to hire Garth to sing my demos. I think I paid him like $40 a pop, maybe 50. Oh.
Hey, this is Party Like a Rockstar podcast, and I'm your host, Joel. Today's episode is brought to you by Misha's Kind Foods. They're an LA-based small business making the world's finest non-dairy cheese on the market today. They're lactose-free, paleo, keto, kosher, perev, and 100% vegan. If you like what you see, check out the next video. If you like this video, please subscribe and like by clicking the little round button on the bottom right. To learn more about me or other guests on the show, go to joelrody.com. You can follow us on Twitter, Instagram, or TikTok. The handle is Joel Rody. If you haven't already read my book, Memoir of a Rody, it's now available through Amazon and paperback Kindle or as an audiobook. I hope you enjoy the show. Bob Reagan is an American country music songwriter. His chart credits include Busy Man by Billy Ray Cyrus. You ever heard of it?
I did.
You heard of that one, George? You heard of that one?
I think I had a hand in that. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Slow down. You're Everything by Keith Urban. Soon by Tanya Tucker. Thinking About You by Trisha Yearwood. Running Out of Reasons to Run by Rick Trevino. Dig Two Graves by Randy Travis. And Till Love Comes Again by Reba McEntire. His friend, George Tarrin, is also a songwriter. His chart credits include Real Good Man by Tim McGraw, I Got My Game On, and Ladies Love Country Boys by Trace Adkins, One of the Boys and Homewrecker by Gretchen Wilson, Heart by Britney Spears, Stealing Cinderella by Chuck Wicks, Straight to You by Ricky Skaggs, and When I Get Where I'm Going by Brad Paisley. I know I could have gone on, guys, but I did stop here. So my intro question I try to have fun with is what's your favorite Elvis song that Elvis wrote?
Elvis didn't write anything. He had his name on all kinds of songs, but he didn't write anything.
Okay, right. So to spawn into the bigger question here, that was my lead in. Have you guys done any ghostwriting? And you don't have to say the name, but have you been in that position? Because with the guys you're writing for, these are big boys. this is the head people in country. Have you been in a position where we're not using your song unless you give us songwriting credit without having even spoken to the artist?
No, that never happened.
Go ahead, Jim.
Well, I was going to say, I've never had that happen. No. You know, there have been a few times, and not so much in the country world, but in the pop world, where I had to give up some publishing, or me and my co-writer had to, and our publishers to play ball. But in terms of giving up co-writing credit, no, never had to do it. Bob, I don't think you did either, did you?
Nope. I've actually put a few artist names on songs that they didn't contribute a whole lot, but that's that's kind of the way the game works.
Yeah, but it's different if the ball's in your court and you're doing it rather than with Elvis, it was I don't think you could even get anywhere unless you agreed. There was nothing to even discuss. So
yeah. Well, a few people I did hear read a story recently where Elvis wrote a record, I Will Always Love You. And Dolly Parton would not, give up any writer's credit on that. And so she was heartbroken, but she had to forego an Elvis cut.
You saw that documentary?
It worked out okay for Dolly.
Yeah, I think it worked out pretty well for her.
Yeah, I don't know.
Good for her, because I'm sure that was a difficult decision.
It would be a really tough one, one that I would have lost. I would have done it in a heartbeat, because we're talking Elvis Presley. And she wasn't where she was in her career at the time. So it's a really, really, really big decision. But lucky for all of us, she made a decision she's happy with, because she became Dolly.
she's got a long track record of making the right decisions.
One of you guys, I know one of you guys, you did a song that she duetted later, right?
Well, she sang on a song of mine called When I Get Where I'm Going.
Okay.
She sang background vocals on that. It was a Brad Paisley cut, but she contributed mightily. So that was really cool.
Super cool. So do you, you know, speaking of the super cool parts, so do you guys get giddy still when somebody picks up your song and it's an artist that you respect? Do you get kind of, and it's not a money thing. I don't mean that money aspect. I mean, the total a little boy in you, does it go, oh boy, this is going to be really cool. Here we go again. Here we go again.
Absolutely. I mean, Georgia and I have had, you know, a lot of songs cut. Some of them, I mean, probably one of my favorite cuts I've ever had was recorded, was a song recorded by Roy Rogers, my cowboy hero.
Yeah.
I remember that.
It didn't sell a lot of units, and he was fairly old and not in great voice, but I display that vinyl record with embossed with Roy and Trigger on the front. That holds a prominent place in my hall.
Is it next to the album Smoky Places in 1983?
No, that one is hidden somewhere in a box. That was a single.
I also have to add that Bob and I have the distinction of having a song that we wrote recorded by Andy Williams,
Moon
River fame, and also by Marsha McCormick, who was
Brady Bunch.
The name of that show?
Marsha, Brady Bunch.
Brady Bunch.
Brady Bunch fame. And I think we might have had one other similar kind of, Garth Brooks's sister cut a song of ours was a single, didn't do very well, but anyway, Bob and I have definitely gotten outside the mainstream of country music together.
We were that close to Garth Brooks. It was just, you know,
right,
just one family member away from
How does that work? He call you? I'm assuming like Pat Alger would just have a lead-in, right, to send him anything he wants, whenever he wants. Do you guys have relationships like that? Because there's artists here where you've done quite a few songs with the same guy. So is it an open door where you can send them whatever you want?
You know, Garth is kind of an interesting case. Over the years, now I've never had a Garth Brooks cut, but he's well known for listening to hundreds, if not thousands, of songs.
Really?
And I remember one time my song plugger got I had left a CD of some songs off for Garth at Alan Reynolds' studio. Garth, and, you know, I didn't think anything, you know, normally you never hear. So Garth calls on the label of the CD was my publishing company. So he calls my publishing company and he says, hey, yeah, I just heard this George Terrence song, and I think it was called, I can't remember the title right now. I wrote it with Tom Douglas, and he goes, oh my God, this song just kills me. I love it. And, you know, of course, my song plugger's getting, you know, totally.
You tell him you had to call him back?
No, he's getting totally jacked up about, you know, that Garth is raving about this song. And it was called Good Morning Sunshine. And it was kind of the idea of the song was a father who's divorced calling his daughter, you know, who is now living with her mother and they're apart. And so he calls her every day to check in. And Garth goes, I got to tell you, this song kills me. He goes, now I'm not going to cut it because it's a little too close to the bone for me right now, because he was getting divorced at the time.
Yeah.
That was one of my Garth.
How about Bittersweet?
Yeah.
Well, I used to, early on, I used to hire Garth to sing my demos. I think I paid him like $40 a pop, maybe 50.
Oh.
But I was not a huge fan of his voice. I'd never seen him live. I thought he was a good singer, but it just wasn't really my cup of tea. So
where are the demos?
They're sitting in my catalog somewhere on a hard drive.
I have to say, I hired Garth for one or two demos and I was kind of underwhelmed. And so, and there was this other guy that I know Bob worked with quite a bit named Billy Dean. And Billy was singing a lot of demos for me. And I go, no brainer, Billy's the guy. And Billy and I think, correct me if I'm wrong, Bob, but Billy and Garth got signed to Capitol Records about the same time, right?
Yeah.
And at the time, if I'd had $100 to bet on either one of them, I would have bet the $100 on Billy, just based on
Yeah. Well, there's so many incredibly talented people that come through, and somebody just has got an amazing look, an amazing voice, and just, that's a star. But there's so many other things that go into it. But I mean, then with Garth and the people that went and actually saw him perform live, it was like, oh, I immediately get it, because he could do this instant connection to a one-on-one, a small room, a big room, a stadium, and he could make you feel like he was singing directly to you, even if you were one of 50,000 people.
There's that
X factor you just don't know.
Right.
Okay, so I got to see Bob play live once, and I've heard both of you guys now sing. You're good singers, and you're good guitar players. So why would you need to hire Garth Brooks? Because you're not intending to sing the song yourself. Isn't the demo good enough with one of you guys? Or how did you decide that it's time for us to hire someone? Were you told to?
Well, when I first got to town, I mean, I sang a lot of my demos, but my voice is not really that country. I came from California, and I just found out that hit the nail on the head. You said you're a good singer.
Yeah.
Now we're eating up with good in Nashville. So I would try to get a great singer, and I would kind of cast around. I had a song, I think, out of the 10 great demo singers I know. So again, some of whom were Alan Jackson at the time, Martina McBride, Joe Diffie. So you would kind of cast what you thought the best voice for that song would be. So I tried to make
it sound. The time is when? We're talking early 80s?
Yeah. This was late 80s.
Late 80s. So how much would you pay a guy to sing a demo?
$40 back in those days.
Yeah, $40.
$40.
But the idea when you do a demo, I would try to make it sound as much like a hit record as I possibly could. And if that meant having someone with a better voice than I sing it, heck yes.
And you're producing it, or you found it?
I found that, you know, the kind of music the kind of songs I wrote were probably, I mean, they weren't real traditional country. And so, I think Bob, you know, probably fell into this too. We wrote stuff for the market, but we weren't like real bone country writers. Yeah. And if we put our voice, his or mine, if we sang the demo, it only took it out of the market a little bit more. Do you know what I mean? So if we hired a guy, there was this one guy that Bob and I both used a lot named Ron Wallace, who was a fabulous country singer. And when I put his voice on my song, even if it was a little left of center, he'd help to pull it back. Do you know what I mean? Okay. And plus, he was such a, you know, his voice was so good, and he was, you know, he got what I did, and he was just great. So once I was able to let go of the fact that I wanted to sing my demos, and I found guys like Billy Dean and Ron Wallace, I realized, you know, that was the right thing to do.
So what's interesting to me, though, is like you have a financial, you have to put money in to get money out. So you have to choose the song because you're paying money for somebody to sing it. Are you engineering and producing it yourself, or you're hiring somebody?
Well, the way the Nashville, and I'm not sure what happens in LA or in the rock world, but in the Nashville country music scene, it was like this for many years when George and I were both active. The publisher would front the money for the demos. So we'd write a song every month or 2 months. You'd go to your publishing company with the 10 or 12, however many songs you had. Then you would all sit down in a group and listen to them and say, all right, I think this is worth spending. I don't know, demos used to cost $500. I guess they got up closer to $750, $800. So the publishers would front that money. But of course, that comes out of it's all going to get recouped out of your eventual earnings if there are any. But that's just, again, the cost of doing business you got to make in order to get that song to hook an artist's ear, make it ear candy. You got to make it sound as much like a hit record as you can, with production, with the great mix, with the great vocalist, with the great background vocals. And so that's and the publisher,
guitars and the groove and all of it, you know, leave little or nothing to the imagination.
And so one of my questions was going to be, so, you know, how do you decide who to write songs with? And so is this stuff, you guys have known each other a long time, but Do you, are a lot of the people that you work with, because you were put together by these labels and that's the reason why you started writing with them, or did you choose most of the people you write songs with?
I got to tell an interesting story here, because
please,
the way I met Bob was, this was probably,
you were one of his groupies in the front row. You were,
no, we were, this was back in the late 80s. Yeah. And Bob is a great guitar player.
Yeah.
And so, and also I've always said he was the hardest working man in show business. I've said that for the last 30 years. But he would, I think the way I met Bob was he was playing acoustic guitar on some of my demos, some of my earlier demos, like back in the late 80s, at this studio called County Q.
Okay.
And I think he was impressed enough with a couple of my songs that, you know, in between songs, you know, and he, I kind of knew that he was a writer, but I didn't know that much. I knew he was a great guitar player. And he sort of said, hey, you know, maybe we ought to get together and write sometime. And I was like, yeah, hell yeah, let's do it, you know. And then that led, I think, Bob, weren't we like doing it at some point every other Tuesday for many years?
Yeah, we did that for a long time.
So back at that point, though, you're putting, I'm presuming, you're writing it on a napkin, on a piece of paper, whatever. You're meeting up every Tuesday, and you're just playing a little bit of what you came up with, and then you see where it takes you guys.
Yeah. Just come up with an idea and just hash it out. But just kind of back to the how do you meet your writers. Later on, when we started in the 80s, it was pretty darned organic. You would always try to write with an artist that was a couple rungs up the ladder from you if you could. But, you know, you kind of had to bring something to the table. So a lot of what I ended up doing when I first got to town was I had to meet other people that were new arrivals. I think George got here in 86. I got here in 85. So I would play in the sessions. And then if I heard somebody whose songs I liked, I'd say, here's what I'm doing. Let's do it. But then later, once you start getting some success and your publisher kind of thinks you might be generating some revenue, then they're going to start, the publisher starts looking for opportunities, and they reach out to their publisher friends and say, we think Bob should get together with, I don't know, Tom Shapiro, Bob should get together with
Bob DePiro.
Who knows? So they try to get your writers to write up to just increase your odds, because there's a lot of great songs, but there are certain names, but those, if you're holding the hot hand and your name is on that song, people go, well, that's just that much more, people, the artist, because it's subjective.
Yeah.
And the other thing, then if your publisher sets you up with another good publisher, then you have two people working that song. So now George is pitching the song to Garth, his publisher is pitching the song to Garth, and his co-writer and the co-writer's publisher are all pitching the song to Garth and everybody else. So it's just a matter of trying to increase your odds in a business with very long odds.
Yeah. Poor Garth's listening to the same song 10 times as he's just trying to drive down the freeway.
Yeah. I had a story like that too. He called up my co-writer on a song, and he was just raving about the song. He sang the song back to him. Same thing. You can record it. No, I don't, that's not right for me, but I just love this song. So a double-edged sword.
Boom, boom, boom.
Yeah. Anyway.
I had on here Bruce Sudano. Bruce is such a nice guy, but he was married to Donna Summer. So he was with Donna Summer for over 30 years, and he's a songwriter too. He did write a song for Dolly Parton and some other stuff. And he said that in the 80s, and I kind of threw it in his face because the song he wrote for Dolly Parton, which I can't remember right now, but it was his biggest hit, was in the 80s. But he said that music changed a bit, and he tried to follow that change. And he thinks it kind of hurt him a bit. You know, he said, I came from a different genre of writing. Do you think you guys are labeled in the same area where you have a specific way of writing? And did you ever try to form to a different or genre or time or period or something to make it work, and found it like really, really hard?
Well, you know, for either Bob or I, who both had pretty long careers as writers, I mean, you know, we started hitting our stride maybe around in the late, for him, maybe in the late 80s, me, maybe a few years later. You have to reinvent yourself a number of times, or you're not gonna, you know, last. And so, you know, we have to, you know, at one point, and I think Bob would, you know, at one point, I think when I was sort of on the upswing and, you know, the newer guy, people were going, oh, that's a George Terence song. That's really cool. And blah, 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 blah. Then they get tired of, you know, or they don't want to hear about the George Terence song. So then you, you know, latch on to somebody else who's on the way up and try to, you know, or other writers. And it's not so much about it being a George Terence or a Bob Regan song, but it's writing the best song you can with maybe some younger, newer guys that are, you know, kind of have the hot hand. Do you agree with that, Bob?
Yeah, I mean, I think the other thing, I would definitely, the styles are changing. You, if you're a commercial songwriter, you have to try to massage, you know, what you're doing to intersect with the market.
Yeah.
Because basically, you really do have your, you know, I'm going to write a little Venn diagram here, a little circle. That's my musical instincts. And then over here is the commercial music. And there's a little parabola right in here where that's where what you do and where the market intersect. So you're working with that, but it's constantly shifting. The other thing is writers, and part of the reason that music changes, writers and artists, we get bored. I don't want to keep doing the same thing. Once I sort of found something, oh my God, I think I'm onto something. This little musical thing feels right. It sounds right. And I want to do this. But then you kind of get tired of it. And every other, because let's face it, the movies, music, books, TV, it's a lot of it is copycat. A lot of it is derivative.
Yeah.
So things wear out. You have, if in Nashville, I don't know how many songwriters there are left, but let's say there were 2000 back when we were doing it. You have all those guys chasing the same, say, all right, what's on the charts this week and how can we emulate it?
Yep.
It's just pretty soon the powers that be get so sick of hearing a certain kind of song, they go, give us something different. So it evolves naturally, and it also evolves because of the songwriters. For me, I get tired of doing something. I want to come up with a chord progression that kind of tweaks my ear and I go, oh wow, I hadn't heard that before. Let me chase that.
Does Nashville care if you're from your Southern boy at all? So like I had on here Cosmo from Creedence Clearwater Revival, and I was telling Bobby, he's from up by you.
But yeah.
Throughout their career, you know, they were assumed to be from the South, and they weren't. None of them were. They're all Northern California guys.
Yeah.
Does Nashville care where you're from, or they just want good songs?
I mean, I think the short answer was surprisingly, when I got here in 85, they didn't really care. When I got here from California, I had a pretty deep appreciation and understanding and reservoir of country songs. So I thought, man, when I get to Nashville, they're going to resent me being from California. But I couldn't find anybody in Nashville who was from Nashville who could to ask them if they resented my arrival.
You know, so, it was so
yeah, I agree. I mean, I think I had a bit more of a learning curve.
Yeah.
To, you know, because I came from Boston. So, you know, I probably wasn't as up on country music as when I moved here as Bob was when he moved here. But no, I never felt it, particularly back in the late 80s through the 90s into the 2000s. It didn't matter where you were from. If you had the song, God bless you, you know.
And that Nashville is a talent magnet. People from all around the country came here and just started mixing and matching. Now, I mean, there are obviously some great writers who are just steeped in the, you know, Southern vernacular, and that comes in handy. But the thing is, I don't try to emulate those guys. I can't do it. It would be disingenuous for me to do it. And it would show up in a hot second if I tried to sound like Craig Wiseman, who grew up in a little town in Mississippi. So I have to be myself. But again, I have to find that place where my skills and the market as it exists intersect.
So I'm some kid. I'm in LA. I'm a kid. I want to become a songwriter. Let's say Nashville. How? So I get asked this a bit because I was a roadie. So, you know, I want to be a roadie. How do I become a roadie? It's a hard question. You know, I don't know. I got lucky. That's with mine. I don't know. But is there a way, is there something that you could tell younger people who want to be songwriters, certain things that they really need to do to give themselves a chance?
Well, that's the one thing I will say, and I'll have to preface anything I say. You can see I'm not a young man, and youth and beauty are the coin of the realm in the music business. So
that's why we run on George.
I can speak at great length from what happened between 85 and 2010. But after that, anybody's guess. But I would say, just write songs, get good. So many people, I hate it for a lot of people that are starting out now, because you have to just, you know, they say fan base, you know, develop your fan base. People are spending all their time on social media trying to, hey, me, look over here. Just freaking, if you got to do it, but take at least that much time or twice that much time working on your craft, mm-hmm. and look at your craft with a really, you know, critical ear and say, what is it that I'm doing right? What is it where I could use improvement and keep getting better, and meet other people that are starting out at your level that you think are talented. I mean, how long does it take you to make a decision about a new artist if you go to hear somebody at a showcase? About 4 bars, 8 bars?
Pretty quick.
You hear that person, go, that person's got it, and you think you got it, then
it actually depends how much I've been drinking.
Yes.
The truth.
So it's the whole market has changed so much when I started doing it, then I'll let George field the rest of the question. When I got here, then this was kind of the biggie. Probably, then correct me the numbers if you'd like, but I think about 2/3 of country artists back in the late 80s and at least the first part of the 90s did not write their own songs.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so there was a Loretta Lynn, a Merle Haggard, a Dolly Parton, a Waylon Jennings. Hell yes, they should be writing their songs. They're artists. They're with a capital A, write your song. But everybody else, when it came time to record a record, they went and they looked for the best song that anybody had written in the last 5 months, 5 years. And so if you had a great song, there were people looking for a great song. But due to a bunch of changes in the music business, basically radio deregulation and peer-to-peer, it really removed the whole album sales out of the equation, and it knocked the one table leg out of the earnings system. And so all the artists at that point, starting about in the mid-2000s or maybe even a little before, the artists started becoming songwriters, even if they weren't really songwriters with a capital S. So then it was not only did you have to write the best song, but you had to write it in the room with the right guy. So then it was a whole different challenge. And I think that's still going on. It's really, I think if I could give any advice to anybody, I think you have to align yourself. I had some people call them camps. You have to network. I used to hate that word because I'm an old hippie, but you have to find other people that are doing what you want to do, get in there next to them. And there are certain places on the musical playing field where there are updrafts. There's somebody that can take that song to market, be it a producer, an artist, a publisher or a label holding the hot hand, and get next to them. But when you get that moment, when you get your chance, you better freaking deliver, because you can't go in there and say, I'm great, watch this, and not be great, because you're done. You won't get another chance.
Yeah. Were either one of your parents supportive, or were they all supportive of you guys going into music?
Yeah, I don't think my parents were. I don't think they understood. I mean, I came from a family, I'm a total anomaly in my family. I mean, everybody in my family on both sides went more into traditional, sales, business, banking, that kind of thing. So I will say my parents didn't discourage me, but I also think they worried. You know what I mean? They're kind of like, really? You think you can make a living doing this? Okay, well, we're behind you. I mean, but, you know, yeah.
And Joel, I'm guessing your parents may have had some second thoughts about you being a roadie.
You know, it was extended family. Like my dad was so happy I had direction, finally something that might lead to something. And then I was seeing the world, and he thought that was really great. Wherever it may lead, at least I'm out doing stuff. And I'm working towards a career. I think he started to worry. My dad was a car. He was a machine shop. He worked his butt off. And I think that diligence of working that many hours, you look and you're like, you hope your kids do something. So I think it was just doing, anything. But some of the extended family, yeah, there, because you were was it philosophy major, Bob, or psychology?
Psychology, but that
That's fluffy as me. You know, I was art history major. So what are you going to do?
And I was an English major.
English major. Yeah, what are we all going to do here?
Well, both my parents passed away when I was very, very young. So neither one of them got to really express themselves, although I'm sure it would have been somewhere between concerned and horrified. George's parents lived long enough for them to see him have some major success. That had to have been gratifying. My parents, you know, when they passed away, the jury was very much out as to where Bob was ever going to amount to Jack, S-H-I-T.
Well, you know what they say, behind every successful songwriter is an astonished father-in-law.
How many of them?
Mine for sure. So,
that's true. My first ex-father-in-law, that's a sentence I can assure you. I can assure you, I never thought I'd be conjugating that. When I first had a hit, he was very gruff and didn't say much, but he looked at me and said, "I never thought I'd be bragging about you." That was a big compliment. It was a big win. Yeah.
That's a big win right there. That's very funny.
I made Rocco Greco brag about me.
That's tough. So one of the things I would assume would be really hard about a songwriting, being a songwriter, would be like, oh, I got an idea. Oh, this would make a great song. And you're just trying to drink your coffee with your friends. Do you get that a lot still, where it's like, that's a great song. Oh, and all the funny ha-has, or not as much?
George?
I'm not quite sure what you mean.
Just to be out and about, I used to write screenplays a bit, and so I'd be like, oh man, I got a great idea for a movie. And then they want you to do all the work, and then they get half the credit. That's at least in the film thing when I was a kid. But I imagine I'll be sitting there, and you and I will have a laugh over watching a roller coaster, and be like, that would be a good song, George. And you're like, everything doesn't have to be a good song, Joel.
Yeah, no, I get that all the, you know, I've gotten that all the time. You know, particularly from people that aren't in the music business, and they're like, oh, wouldn't this be a great song idea? Why don't you go write that? And I go, yeah, well, there have been a few times where the idea has been really good, and I go, well, yeah, I'll run with that, and, you know, cut them in. But
how many girlfriends and wives, though? Well, why don't you write a song about me?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, there's plenty of reasons to do that. My standard joke is from my Keith Urban song, I Want to Be Your Everything. I say it's possible to write a song that will pay for the divorce from the girl you wrote it for.
That's pretty funny.
But you know, back to the idea thing, I mean, sure. George is easily as hardworking as I. I mean, in fact, it's not just he and I can't really think of too many slackers. In Nashville, no. Maybe if there's one small percentage of people, I don't know, 2%, that are so freaking talented, they can come through just with a trail of disaster and, you know, behind them and still write such brilliant songs. But for the most, and just slack off and fish and get drunk, almost to a man and a woman, the people that have had success in this town that I know, just get up and work.
Yeah.
And I would also, back to the ideas, and probably George would concur, I just had these antenna for song titles.
Yeah, me too. It was
tiresome for anybody else, but I'd be listening, you know, just to something on the news, something I heard in the conversation, just things were popping in there. But if you're
from a movie,
you're up to speed and you're being paid, and at the peak of your career, you're getting paid a pretty good amount of money to write songs, you just say, I've got to keep this centrifuge whirling. And the feeder for that is the ideas. Once you have a skill set and know how to write an idea, the idea is the currency, because if you don't have a good idea and the song is just, you know, just three chords and a bunch of blather. So
yeah, you can write a great melody and a cool groove and a good lyric, but if the idea is lame, the song's not going to really fly.
Yeah, it's like when I get where I'm going, the George's Brad Paisley song. That's, you know, basically when I get where I'm going, you know, on the other side. Can't remember the lines, but I'll match my grandpa's stride for stride, which I thought was a great line. So you try to get something that, if you try to write clever, you're sunk. I mean, if you have a great clever idea, go ahead and write it. But you want to get something heartfelt. And if you can make it where it resonates with you emotionally, then it's probably going to resonate, since we're all human, or most of us are. It'll resonate with other humans. But if you're just trying to do some elaborate construct of get a line, you know, if my heart could dance, it would have two left feet. You know, people, oh, that's funny. Let's write that. That's a waste of time. Don't do it. Find something emotionally resonates and something that matters. If it's a party song, write a party song, but make it fresh.
Yeah. So how do you write Dig Two Graves, read the lyrics of Dig Two Graves? Is your thought process, how the hell am I going to ever do better than this? Or are you just excited in the moment? I mean,
well, I'll tell you a funny story about how that song came to be written. Okay. I'll try to make it quick. I had seen an old Chinese proverb somewhere, and I wrote it down in my list of titles. And I still, it's probably about 15 pages of titles, and those are just the ones I haven't written. There's a Chinese proverb that said, if you seek revenge, first dig two graves.
Oh.
So I had kind of fooled around with it and run it by a few people, you know, thinking, let's write a revenge song, something nice.
Not dark. Me, unfortunately, but.
Let's run something dark and bloody by this and, you know, turn to make it a revenge song. But my co-writer, Ashley Gorley, who went on to be probably the most successful songwriter in Nashville, but at the time he hadn't written any hits, and he said, oh man, this is a love song. So I just went, of course it's a freaking love song. So off we went. So yeah, that was, but that, the cool thing about that song, it came from a Chinese proverb and it ended up being something completely different, but it emotionally resonated, because every time I play that song, people come up and say, oh my God, my grandparents passed away within days, weeks of each other. And it's, you know, just, it's an emotional truth that nobody else had actually written.
Yeah. So, yeah, I told Bob when I spoke to him how I met him, George, I got invited to this songwriter thing, and I'd co-written a song for Darius Rucker. And there was, I don't know, how many people were there, Bob? Maybe 40 people. It was very small. And it was Bob, Maya Sharp, and then I think three other guys on the stage, too.
It was Jimmy Ritchie and Kendall Marvel.
Okay. And Bob was like the boss. You know, they each guy would play, and they're all so good. And then every now and then they look over like, okay, Bob. And then he'd play this thing. And for whatever, the one that hit me was that Dig Two Graves song. And I laughed when you played it, thinking, well, this guy won the game, man. I mean, how could anybody write better than that? And I was so appreciative that I got to see this. I didn't understand how I got invited, but I was so happy I was there. And I went up to Bob after, and I'm like, I want to write a song with you. And he kind of laughed.
Oh, please, I'm going to cover my ears now.
He kind of laughed. And then I drove all the way home thinking, geez, these guys are good. I mean, where do you even begin to write stuff that's just so poetic, that just fits the groove so well? And it was like the best, and I'd seen Guns N' Roses and Stone Temple Pilots and some of the biggest and greatest bands in the world. There really are. But a guy with a guitar singing his heart out was just the best thing I had done in so many years. And all these years later, I still smile away thinking of that one night. And it's such a great idea or a concept that music can be that simple. Just a guy with a guitar and speak to you for so long. It's a good thing. So, you know, I take my hat off to you. We're all bold.
How do you write that? I mean, I bet I've written over to somewhere between 2,500 songs. So I've
you have 220 something registered under ASCAP, I saw.
Well, I mean, yeah, they don't I don't bother to register every song. The ones that get recorded, mostly they do. I've probably got a couple hundred songs recorded by different artists, but you just have to write a lot of songs. Back to our advice to anybody else to get into this, just write songs. And if you write a song, if you get stuck, set it aside and write another one. Just get in the habit of writing. Everybody I know, again, that succeeded has written thousands of songs, I'll bet. You have an idea what your catalog is, George?
I don't know how many songs I've written. I think I've had about the same number recorded as you, around 200 or so.
Yeah.
Although, you know, there's probably 30 or 40 that have accounted for most of my income over the years.
But that's the crazy thing about it. You could write for an entire career. I think I wrote probably 30 plus years as a staff writer. If I could have just picked out those 20 days in those 30 years to show up for work.
Oh, wow.
Right.
Man, I would have had the best life ever.
Yeah,
once
no
every
doubt.
6 months, go in and write a song that's a hit and head
Here's
out.
A fun one. What do you have any funny gigs that you guys performed at? Places that you're like, I can't believe I'm playing here tonight. Just an odd place. I'm assuming back in the beginning, you guys were doing like coffee shops and stuff when you were kids or never?
Well, Joe, I came up a little different than George. Go ahead, George.
Well, I mean, I think Bob played in a lot of bands and stuff, and I played in a few, but they never lasted very long. It seemed like every time we got our shit together and felt like we were ready to, you know, hit the ground, somebody'd leave and whatever. So I mostly did solo gigs or duos, that kind of thing. I remember one time, and I had this guy who said he was going to start booking me and another guy that I played with. We were a duo, and we were mostly doing, you know, James Taylor, Crosby, Stills, and Nash, you know, that kind of stuff. This is back in the mid-70s, late 70s. And the guy got us a gig at a Christmas party. And we didn't quite realize, you know, it was like a, hotel's Christmas party. Well, it was a train wreck because they wanted to rock. They wanted to, you know, dance. And we couldn't really deliver on that. So that was a long 2.5 hours, I can tell you that.
one of my more memorable gigs, there's so many of them, because I played in the bars when I started out. I mean, one fortunate thing in the time that I came up when I was a kid in the 60s, if you wanted to play guitar, you started a band. So all these kids in the neighborhood, none of us could play, but we were enthusiastic, so we'd just start playing in bands. So that was kind of my entree. So I played in bands from the time I was in high school all the way through college, kept the lights on all the way into Nashville. But we were kind of a big deal in Sacramento in the 70s, and we were the band of choice for the Sacramento chapter of the Hells Angels.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So we played parties, weddings, just little confabs where they would get together with the Galloping Geese and the Satan Slaves and the Angels, carve up the Central Valley. And we'd play our heart out, and they'd just look at us. And I know they liked us because they paid us and kept having us back, but they weren't about to clap.
Talk about
and
a rough.
And I wasn't about to berate them and demand that they appreciate my songs.
Anybody want an encore? Okay, we'll give it to you anyway.
Yeah.
That's a great one. I like it. Okay, so when I was first going to put together a podcast, my friend's fifth grade daughter, she said, you need to ask every person who comes on when they first felt famous. It's actually been one of the best questions yet, because you don't have to feel famous. We're talking about a little kid. So it doesn't have to be fame. It could be where you felt you were on your way. There was a moment in your career that you felt success. It was a little kernel of time that made you feel good about what you were doing. What would you guys choose?
George?
Well, I mean, it might be, I'd had a few close to top 10 hits in the early 90s, but Bob and I had a song called Running Out of Reasons to Run that became our first number one song. And leading up to that, you know, I had two kids and a wife, and I was working not only writing songs, but I was also writing and producing commercials, jingles, whatever you want to call them. And when I got that number one song, and I hate to say it, but the money that came with it, I finally felt like, okay, I've made it as a songwriter. Maybe I can start to let go of some of this other stuff. And it was a weight off my shoulders. I felt like, okay, yeah, I can do this, you know. And then I actually had another number one within about 6 months. So that really, Yeah.
Well, for me, it was probably my first hit with my Reba song in '89, because at this point I was almost 40 years old, because I'd beaten my brains out in the clubs in Sacramento until I was 30, Then I moved to LA and had a short-lived record deal and on Curb Records in LA, none of which generated any money. And I had a wife and two little kids, kind of like George. So I was just struggling mightily and just trying to keep the lights on with 50 or 60 bucks a night. But I wanted to be a songwriter. But until you actually have something you can, an accomplishment you can hang your hat on. And so that was for me, it was a big one. So, oh my God, I checked the box. All of this wandering around, being a guitar player, maybe a singer, a failed record deal, failed club gigs. And then I finally rang the bell once. Now, if it happens again, that's great. And I'm gonna do everything I can to make sure it happens again. But once I did that, I didn't feel famous, but I felt like now I'd accomplished what I set out to do. And I hope it happens again, but if it doesn't, I'll always have this.
Validation, basically. Yeah.
The other thing, the one that was the most, when I felt, it sounds kind of silly, but people say, what was the real peak experience in this? It was in like 1977, the Northern California Battle of the Bands. And we won out of like 200 acts. But we didn't know anything. And I didn't know what success was, but it was, as far as our arena, that was as big as it got.
Yeah.
So we weren't expecting to win. So we kind of went from this level here all of a sudden to, oh my God, we just won. It was like, you know, a couple of days of just pure joy and elation. And then it all kind of settled in. It didn't really mean anything. But so much of the things that happened in Nashville, they happened so incrementally because let's just say we wrote a song, Running Out of Reasons to Run. We liked it, great demo. So then the label says, okay, we like this song, we want to hold it. Then that sits there for a month, 6 weeks. Oh yeah, the artist likes it. You're on the comp tape along with 25 other songs. Then, you know, the time goes by. Well, okay, we recorded it, but we recorded 15 songs for a 10 song CD. So by the time something happens, you're greeted with relief as much as elation, because it's like, oh, wow. And then if it gets on the charts, then you start sweating the freaking charts, which sounds stupid. That's a wonderful problem to have, but you're looking, oh my God, if it lost two stations or something that week, you go, oh my God, the record's over. Yeah. Happened.
We worked so hard to get it, you know, to get this single out. And now we've got to sweat every week to hope that it keeps climbing.
You know, yeah, so again, it's a combination of relief and elation and just.
Did either of you have one that was just easy, like the guy, you know, okay, I'll sing it. And it's just, you didn't even have a lot of work to do. Just boom, 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 boom.
You mean in terms of writing the song?
Writing. So you wrote something and there wasn't all the hoops. Before you knew it, the guy said he would sing it. The song becomes a hit and you're kind of laughing away like, God, if they could all be that easy.
Well, I had one. And that was a song on Gretchen Wilson called Homewrecker.
Yeah.
And I wrote that with her and Rivers Rutherford. And we literally wrote that like the week before she was going into cut. Okay. And we wrote it in probably about 3 hours. Turned out that Rivers had a demo session the next night. So we demoed the song and they cut it the next week. And it ended up being, I think, the second or third single off the record. So, wow. I mean, that was pretty quick. Yeah.
Stealing Cinderella wasn't as fast.
You know, Stealing Cinderella was pretty quick too, because we wrote that with Chuck Wicks a week before he was cutting. And I think that was his first single actually. So yeah, that was quick too. Yeah.
Are we starting to sense a pattern here?
Yeah.
Kids, pay attention, pro tip. Right with the artist.
Right with the artist. Studio. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, because in both of those cases, I wrote with the artist and I wrote it, you know, just happened that we wrote those songs within a week or two of when they were going into cut. And yeah. And that's really important. As I say, it's the fresh baked cookie syndrome, which is, you know, if you can get a song in there, you know, and it doesn't sit on the shelf for too long, so it's a fresh baked cookie. That's good, because if it sits on the shelf for too long, it's, even though the song is still a great song, it starts to get a little stale. Maybe the artist has been listening to it a lot and he still likes it, but you know, he's getting used to it. Maybe he's having second thoughts, but
a new shiny toy comes in the door.
Yeah, you never
know. Something new comes in and he goes, oh, I think I like this better, you know.
Because I know, like, Darius, I was told, he's got a lot of songs that he hasn't released yet. I'm assuming a lot of these guys have a lot of songs, too.
But the label controls all those in most cases. I'm not sure what Darius. I really dug your song, by the way. I did listen to that.
Thank you.
That was a Hootie and the Blowfish before Country Darius, right?
It was in between. It was just before he was going. So Hootie and the Blowfish was the opening band for Toad the Wet Sprocket. So where you say write for the artist. So I wrote it with one of the guys from Toad the Wet Sprocket. I'm a very big Nancy Griffith fan. And so Darius found it very funny that I liked him because of Nancy, and I didn't really know Hootie as well as the other people, and that I was working for Guns N' Roses. And then the other writer, Toad the Wet Sprocket, actually wrote a song about Nancy Griffith. So Darius, on his own dime, flew to California, and he sang the song, and he paid for everything. And
that's so cool.
What a class act, right? I mean, how can you beat that? And I didn't know him. I had had a conversation on the phone with him. And then I remember I went, I'm like, can you sing this one too?
Yeah.
I remember Dean, he's the Toad the Wet Sprocket guy. He just looked at me like, stop. Like, what are you doing? No.
Yeah. So we're ahead of the game. Stop.
We're ahead of the game. Just smile.
Don't push your luck, buddy. Right.
Well, you know, I don't know. So, but you know, what a good guy. What a really, really, really good guy. So yeah. that was a feather in my hat. It was a cool moment.
And that's great.
A bit of luck. It was.
Congrats.
So I'd love to ask you here about Operation Song. And my question would be, is it who do you think is having more fun, the veterans or the songwriters? Because it sounds to me like it would be a really good time just to sit and write songs together. But maybe you can explain better what the organization's about, because to make it make sense.
Yeah, basically, so in the mid-2000s, probably like starting 2003 to maybe 2010 or 11, I did a bunch of Armed Forces Entertainment tours. We had a songwriter band. We traveled around the world playing at military bases. And I met a whole bunch of men and women serving, and I was a civilian, so my head kind of exploded with everything, the different demographic depth and breadth of the people serving. But then just the great stories you would hear. And this was during the peak of Iraq and switching to Afghanistan. And I thought, well, songwriters are armchair therapists. Maybe if we put pro songwriters together with veterans, active duty, and their family members, we can help them sort out some of this stuff. So that was the impetus for Operation Song. And I definitely had no idea what I was getting into when starting a nonprofit. I didn't intend to start a large nonprofit.
Oh, it's a lot of work.
It's still a small one. It's an immense amount of work.
Yeah.
But it was so well received by the military community, the therapeutic community, and the songwriters that we just kept going. And now we've written probably close to or at 1,000 songs with veterans of World War II, Korea, Vietnam, Iraq, Afghanistan, their families, their kids, their parents.
Oh, great.
So it's really remarkable. But as far as who's, I'm not sure, fun, maybe rewarding would be the term I would use for everybody involved. Because a lot of times the people in the rooms, something about the songwriting process gets people to open up. And once they do that, they start talking about things that are important to them. And oftentimes we don't push people to tell us about something traumatic or emotional or something that happened on the battlefield.
Yeah.
People get talking, but very often comes around to that. They're trying to make sense of things. And that's what a song does. It takes a bunch of a big jumble of information and hangs it on a narrative arc propped up by music and resolution, lyrical and musical resolution. And it's just truly amazing. But so everybody finds that really rewarding, especially the songwriters too, because as I may have said, I don't want to harp on this, but sometimes if you're trying to write commercial songs, you kind of have to write about a certain subject matter. But the subject matter in these songs, when somebody's sitting across from you and trusts you enough to tell you about something that he went through or something that he's struggling with, the songwriters really take that responsibility to heart and try to have their work be worthy of the sacrifice that it took to have that story to tell.
Yeah.
You want to do justice to their experience and their story. And as Bob said, it's cool because instead of sitting back and trying to contemplate or anticipate what the market is going to want. You really are sitting there, and the only person you have to please is the guy sitting in the room with you. And yeah, if you bring it home for him, you've done your job.
And that's, I mean, I would imagine it'd be a very emotional experience for a lot of these guys. And you know, what could be more rewarding for the songwriter? I think it's a great idea.
People want to write songs that matter. I mean, people get into this because the music they heard, at least in my generation, the music we heard growing up, music freaking mattered.
Yeah. You know?
And so you want to write something that matters. And this is, again, it's probably, we're hoping that, I'm knocking on wood, we're hoping that some of these songs get out and are hits and touch millions and millions of people. But right now we're touching thousands and tens of thousands of people. But more importantly, we're just helping that one person express themselves and to feel like they're heard.
And then Life Raft. Is Life Raft still going on, George? Are you involved in it or?
Peripherally. I mean, my son had cancer, and the Life Raft group was a help to us in terms of negotiating all of that. And so, I donate to them, and I've done some musical stuff for them. They're not really, I did a kind of a theme song for them maybe 6 or 8 years ago.
Yeah, I heard it online. Yeah.
Which they still use, I guess. But, you know, it's a whole different thing than Operation Song. You know, I guess when they found out that I was a songwriter and had some success, they asked me to come up with a song for them. But but they're more of an advocacy group for cancer patients than having anything to do with music. Yeah.
Oh, okay. That was good. Okay. Well, where can we find out about Operation Song? Is it, do you have operationsong.com or?
Yes. If you go, it's operationsong.org.
.org. Okay.
And something I learned, that .org is always nonprofit. So if you're looking for a nonprofit, they should always say .org on the end. So that's where that comes from. Yeah. Just look us up. I think probably a lot of bang for your click. If you go to our YouTube channel, just go to Operation Song on YouTube, put that in your search field. We write a lot of songs. We also encourage the veterans to maybe come up with pictures of things that kind of help tell the story. We can't do it with every song, but we've probably got 40 or 50 really compelling videos that go along with the songs too.
Oh, that's cool.
Check out our YouTube channel.
You know, it was funny, George, when I first started talking to Bobby, he's like, well, maybe we should pick a songwriter from like metal music or like rock and roll or something. I'm like, yeah, whatever. That could be fun. You know, let me see what I could come up with. And then he calls me like the next day and he goes, want to go on with George Tarrant? Like, he's like the biggest name in Nashville. That's not what we talked about yesterday. So it was, I love how this all came together. I appreciate both of you guys coming on. Like,
oh man, my pleasure. Great to meet you.
I was so excited. I even called my mom. I was like, you're not going to believe I'm going to talk to you today. And, from a guy who's written or tried to write a couple songs, it's really exciting to have the opportunity.
You know what? I have to say that's a little disheartening. Even though I'm looking at myself on the screen, I like to think of myself as virile and 22. I was hoping you might talk to your daughter and she would be excited. But no, it's your mom.
No kids yet. No kids. Otherwise, I'd force them all to listen. I'd be like, yeah. So I've been trying. I've tried to tell him I wanted him to record an album, but he's not very interested in doing it, he says. So
I've done some little CDs late in my tenure as a staff writer. I started going back and writing 100% songs, where I went back and I would sing them and I would produce everything, play everything on my Pro Tools, and just try to get it as good as I can. So if you'd like, I can send you. I've done some CDs on that, but I need to come up with a playlist because I love it.
I want to hear Dig Two Graves with you singing it.
Now I'll have to dig three graves, one for you, me, and George.
Okay. All right. Well, really, truly, thank you.
Hey, my pleasure. So fun to do.
Yeah.
Always happy to talk about myself. Yeah.
Thanks for watching. Don't forget to like and subscribe by clicking the round button on the bottom right. To learn more about me or the guests on the show, go to joelrody.com. You can follow us on Twitter, Instagram, or TikTok. The handle's Joel Rody. And don't forget, when you party like a rock star, don't be a dick.